All right, now it is my pleasure to introduce tonight's honorary warm-up speaker. Please help me offer a warm welcome for Pete of Los Angeles.
Hi, everybody. My name is Pete. I'm an alcoholic. And hello, everybody on Zoom. It's beautiful to see you, and I'd like to welcome everybody here that's new and that stood up, and it's beautiful to be here. Thank you, Bill, and it's beautiful to be here with Sharon, my sweetheart. We came up from Los Angeles today, and thanks for the workshop for you guys. We didn't hear all of it, but what I heard was fantastic. And, wow, I have a sobriety date, November 16th, 1991. The miracle there is Alcoholics Anonymous. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous when I was 19 years old. And I was crazy. I was a mess. I thought I was having a heart attack. And I had no idea what had just happened. I drank for 3 years and 3 months. And I thought, how could this have happened? My incredible solution, which was alcohol, had like turned on me. And I was in all this trouble. I had gotten arrested for DUI in October of 1991. The cops in Virginia saved my life. And I'll share a little bit with you about what happened to me. Actually, I did not know I was an alcoholic, and this was the key. One of the things that I heard a little bit earlier today was knowing what my problem is, and then getting into the book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I didn't really know that until I was about 2.5 years sober, and I moved from Pennsylvania to Montana, and I ended up getting a sponsor who read the book Alcoholics Anonymous to me. And I am so grateful for that. And, I heard about statements in the questions, and I needed that. And I still need that. There's a guy who on Zoom here who I met in 1995. I love what we read there about life takes on new meaning and working with others. That has saved my life. Mr. Tim Kay, who's on there, I had a chance to see him when he came in. And to share with him what was given to me when I moved out there. I had no idea you take alcohol away from me, I am restless, I am irritable, and discontent. I am a mess. I am that way today with 30 years of sobriety. I need a solution, and I had no idea. Always needed a solution. And see, when I started to go through and identify with what is written in our book, I started to see that, yeah, that's me. I am restless. I drank for the effect produced by alcohol. I have a phenomenon of craving when I drink. That night I got arrested for DUI. If anybody here has had one of those, I probably should have had more than one, I'll tell you that much. I used to love to drink and drive. I did it right from the beginning. Not condoning that, of course, not endorsing it, but I did it. And I guarantee you, boy, you put booze in me, I'd probably do it again. Because I have an allergy, and I can't stop once I start. And that night I got arrested. I tell you what, I was literally straddling the keg that night, and I had a fake ID, and I was driving home in a blackout. And when the cops pulled me over, I was in suburban Washington D.C. where I grew up. Next thing I know, I'm out there failing that sobriety test. If anybody's ever had to fail one of those, you can't go backwards. You can't count anything. And he pulls out my fake ID and he goes, "Are you Peter Douglas from West Virginia?" And lo and behold, I was taken in that police car, and I was, I felt something change. I felt a shift. I felt something happen. I felt the gig is going to be up. And I drank for another month after that. And actually, when I came in AA, I was at that part in the big book that is a jumping off place. I cannot live with alcohol, and I can't live without it. And actually, it's a beautiful point of desperation. It's like that solution isn't working, but yet I have a mind that condemns me to drink. I have a mind that won't remember any of the pain or suffering and I had no idea that I suffer from this malady. I had no idea that because I am living the way I live and that I am so focused on myself and I'm so consumed with all this anxiety and fear. See, I never felt like I fit in anywhere. really, Alcoholics Anonymous is one of the most beautiful things that has ever happened, because I heard you talk. When you started to share about not fitting in, I identified. When you started to talk about, man, I've got anger and I'm scared and I've got all this fear, I identified. Not right away, but I started to identify and I started to feel like, man, this, I might be like you guys. I might actually be alcoholic. Anyways, I came in when I was 19 and I was angry. Man, I would be in meetings in State College, Pennsylvania, and every word that came out of my mouth is a word I cannot utter from the podium right here. I wouldn't want to. I was not speaking to my family. Actually, my life got worse. Actually, after I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I had no idea that I was dealing with alcoholism in its untreated form, and that I absolutely needed, I was just getting angrier and angrier, and you were getting more and more wrong, and I was getting more and more right. And I tell you, that's a death sentence for an alcoholic. Death sentence. Today, if I get more and more, if you get more and more wrong and I get more and more right, that's not a good way to be in a relationship. It's not kind, it's not loving, and it's certainly not helping anybody else. So I tell you what, I had to get busy, and I'm so grateful that the people, I heard a man by the name of Don P. share in Bozeman. And when he shared, I ended up moving to Bozeman, Montana, because of what I heard that day. And then I heard about the Pacific Group, and I heard about Clancy, and I heard about an ethic that I wasn't doing. I wasn't thinking of you. I found a group that was enthusiastic, that actually cared about service, that cared about the fellowship, that cared about working the steps, the three legacies that we have. It was explained to me that there's a lot to do here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I had 2.5 years, and I hadn't done any of it. I was one foot in, one foot out. I was still very much a taker. And what I've realized today is that, I don't know, if I'm a taker, I'm going to die here. I'm going to die here. And so I started to get busy. What I can share with you is that what I needed to do is that I needed to do the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I needed to get honest. I needed to get rigorously honest with those resentments. I needed to get rigorously honest with all those fears. And I needed to see me. And then I needed to start to carry this message. But one of the things, and we talked about there's the primary purpose, is that with about 5 or 6 years of sobriety, I forgot what my primary purpose was. And actually, I have some experience of what that's like when that primary purpose becomes me, when that primary purpose becomes my career, when my primary purpose becomes looking good as a sports writer, which is what I was doing in Bozeman, Montana, and then all of a sudden I'm worried more about that than I am about Alcoholics Anonymous. When I start to get resentful at my home group, and I fire the home group, and I fire the sponsor, and I start doing things like that separate me from you, and that I'm dying, I am in a sicker state in sobriety than I even was when I got here. I'm shooting the people that had carried the message to me. And I have experience doing that with 28 years of sobriety too. I've had moments where I've gotten new sponsors and I've redoubled my efforts, and this pandemic has saved my life. It introduced me to Zoom, and it wasn't just it putting me in Zoom, but I was living in China, and I was doing research for my doctorate degree, and I was basically lying to the Chinese government, I was lying to the U.S. government, I was lying to my sponsor, I was lying to my boss, I was lying to my parents, and I was lying to sponsees, and I was in that spot where no longer could I see anything that fourth column and that fourth step shows us what I need to see. No longer could I see the defects of character. I was lost. I remember when I came back from that and I was asked to share my story, I didn't know what it was. I did not know what my story was because I was so consumed with myself. I knew stuff that had happened in the past. But I realize today that I cannot live off of yesterday's recovery. It absolutely has to be current. Very current. I have to do the step work, not because I'm doing it for self-knowledge, but because I want that relationship, and that the real reliance must come on a power greater than myself. I heard people talk about being awake. I was asleep. I was asleep at the wheel, doing things that I didn't want to do, doing things that I thought you guys were the ones that always, you know, had affairs. You guys were the ones that lied and did stuff like that. You know, cheated on your taxes. I don't do stuff like that. Well, guess what? I did. All of that experience, you know, and there I was, needing help. And what the pandemic did for me is it grounded me. I needed to ask for help, and I got a man. I'm going to wrap up in a second here. And I needed to start to clean up the mess of the present. I needed to get back into the steps. I needed to get in touch with that great reality that is deep down within. My relations with my parents had gotten so far askew that the amends that I had made to them, actually, that wasn't really an amends at all, and I have way more amends work to do. And that, really, it's where the transformation in Alcoholics Anonymous comes when I make those amends. And I'm in the process of doing it right now. I actually had a chance to see my father a couple of weeks ago, and we went through a conversation that was basically, no, this is not your fault. This is mine. I have to own what's absolutely going on. And so I got back in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous, going to Zoom meetings, reconnecting with my old home group, blooming where I'm planted. And actually, it got me to a spot where I ended up moving here to Los Angeles after I met Sharon and ended up, I don't know what love and kindness is. I don't know what love is. I was so scared of that. I don't want you around me. And so I didn't realize that all of my defects of character were pushing you away. And so what's happening now is that I'm learning how to be not only in a relationship, but I'm actually going through this work, going through the traditions and seeing where I can be of maximum service in my home and in Alcoholics Anonymous in Los Angeles and with guys that I sponsor, with my parents, learning how to act better than I feel and do more than I ever was doing before. So what I've realized is that just because I've got 30 years of sobriety means I've got to stay busy, I've got to stay active, I've got to stay committed, and do more than I was doing before. Because my real reliance is on a power greater than myself. It's not on human power. And I need to do the work that puts me in touch with that. So my time is up. We have a wonderful speaker that's going to share with you tonight, and I am so grateful to be here tonight. Thank you.
Come on, all those folks need to come back inside. Now it's my privilege to introduce tonight's main speaker. Please help me offer a warm Tulare County welcome to our speaker tonight, Sharon C. of Los Angeles. Hi, I'm Sharon, alcoholic. Well, before I thank Bill and the committee, I want to thank everybody who went and got me chocolate. It says in the book, we got to have chocolate. So I was out there looking for it, and the word got out before they found the stash of chocolate. And it was grass, and who's the other guy? I wrote his name down. You guys were so funny. It was like they were looking in their pocket, and they'd come up to me and pull out of their pocket chocolate. It's just kind of like, is anybody looking? It's like there was no chocolate around, so... thank you so much for the chocolate, because I actually ran into a cupboard one night, and I had a black eye. So, you know, I have to go speak at a meeting, and they're all looking at me like, what it used to be like, right? And I said, you guys aren't going to believe it, because you know how we all think about it, right? And I said, I ran into a cupboard in the middle of the night looking for chocolate. And this old-timer came up to me and he said, I just want to let you know what I do. You know, I know we need chocolate, but keep it in your nightstand. And I thought, old-timer knowledge, I just love it. Thank you, Bill. Thank you for the honor of being here. Thank you. Leah did all the work, and Sam, yeah, met you right away when I walked in with your flower on. And all my Zoom friends and Pete's Zoom friends and everybody's Zoom friends, and Jolene, that had 48 years. I always want somebody in the room. Please have more time than me. Please have more time than me, because I have a day at a time. I got a day at a time here. And God,
Selena and Paulette Penelope, the little babies. The mother said to me, they were all here for the books. Wasn't that beautiful, Bill, and I got to give those books? And they said they want those little girls to grow up and be best friends because their moms are sober moms, and we will support you doing that. That's right. So thank you, Bill, for the honor. Suzanne, it's nice to sit with you, Connie, and Ken, and John. And thank you, Pete, for being my mate and driving up here so I could take a nap and not hear you hit those little things on the side of the road that make you go bump, 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 bump. He moved out here from Chicago about, not even a year ago, but just about, we dated for 7 months on FaceTime, met on Zoom. Okay. How many alcoholics have dated before you really met somebody, you know what I mean? 7 months, right? It was only through the pandemic and Zoom. I mean, it was crazy. So when we finally met, it was effortless. And I was a widow 10 years. But you know what? That's what we were talking about. John and I were talking about, you don't know. I don't know what's down the road for me. I've been in my 46 years. I'm sure an alcoholic, man, totally alcoholic. And I don't know what's down the road. I mean, I've been through life, the death, and life doesn't stop. But I know when I wake up every single morning since August 20th, 1975, that I'm sober. I know that. Yeah. Right? We know that. Every day. That's what it is. I don't know what life's going to throw at me, but the only way I can be prepared is to start my day with my higher power, which is, to me, is everlasting love. I don't know, I've been through a lot of higher power stuff, but I kind of like what Chuck C. talks about in his book, you know, that love is 1,000 to nothing. And we do this for fun and for free, and it's not 50-50 or 70-70, it's 1,000 to nothing. And I used to have this girl that would call me a lot, Sharon, I don't get this 1,000 to one thing. It's like, no, Sydney, it's 1,000 to nothing. And then she'd call me a week later, Sharon, I don't get this 1,000 to one thing. You know, it's like he used to talk about you don't see till you see, and you don't hear till you hear. And so I keep coming around the rooms to see more and to hear more and to understand more and to be able to, as I wrote in the books, page 77, our real purpose is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and the people about me. And I looked my whole life for purpose. I want to make sure I said thank you to everybody because this has been, I just feel at home here. I just feel so at home here. Alcoholics Anonymous is the first place in my whole life that I felt like I found a purpose. And I'm a seeker. The book talks about, you know, feet in the ground, head in the clouds. I mean, but our work is to be done here. And that's why I have smart feet today. I've been taught to have smart feet and show up. Because if I hadn't stayed all these years, I wouldn't be sober. And I'm a runner. I what's your name? Where do you want to move to? Sure, let's go. Pack up, you know. And I've had adventures before. You know, lots of adventures before. But stick around for the adventures after. Stick around for those adventures after because, I know it's a singleness of purpose here, but I did like a lot of orange sunshine along with my wine and my tequila and my vodka and my Jack Daniels and my Thunderbird because it would fit in my boots and my Mason, the other boot, just because I hitchhiked a lot. So, you know, I was a survivor. I was definitely defiant and I was a survivor and I came into you desperate and dying and I thought that was going to be... That was it. I was ready to go. I had lost my humanity, and I grew up in a beautiful family in Iowa. Beautiful. At 6, I realized it was Iowa, and I went, what the heck? Why am I in Iowa? I didn't know about love, and I knew about God, and it was all great, and we had traditions, and my dad was Czech, and we had a lot of fun, And it wasn't so cool to play the accordion when you're like 14, but I was doing it anyway because I like my dad's approval. 4 kids and I'm the alcoholic. I'm the one that's restless, irritable, and discontent. I'm the one that has to have them stop the car as we're leaving Grandma and Grandpa's house because stop. I say, what? I gotta go. I gotta go see Grandma and Grandpa one more time so they would open the door, let me run the block back down to Grandpa and Grandma's because they're gonna die before I see them again. I was very intense about things. I was very intense about my feelings. So much so that, you know, they didn't take me to funerals anymore because I touched Aunt Till's hand and it was cold. And then the smell of lilies haunted me for 2 weeks and I couldn't sleep. And they said, I'm taking her to, you know. And my younger sister said, why is Sharon in everything? We got her in tap and ballet. And, I mean, whatever there was. I played 3 instruments. I was in art class. And my mother told my sister, because we had to keep her busy. We had to keep her busy. And when I found alcohol... I was 12. I was in a t-shirt, cut-off jeans, probably barefoot, with the neighbor boys in their 57 Chevy, which was very cool. And they let me hang out. And we went to what they call, we had woodsies in the Midwest. It was where you all come somewhere and bring your cars, and there's the booze and the party, and they turn the radio stations to the same radio station, and... And there I was with the football players and the cheerleaders, and you know I'm sitting next to Miss 38D. I'm thinking, what is she doing in a mohair sweater in the middle of summer, tucked into her little jeans? Well, I saw when she turned sideways what she was doing, and you know she had those little white sneakers on and tan legs, and I was looking at her and looking at my trainer bra, wondering what it was training for. And but I'll tell you what made it wake up was a lot. Oh, my God. Seagram 7 Schlitz beer. Oh, thank you, Canadian whiskey. Thank you, Canada. I'll tell you. Thank you, Canada. And I took a big pull off that and the Schlitz beer chaser, and I came around and I took another. And, oh, it burned. I was like, yeah, that part of my reptilian brain just went, just relaxed. And I'll tell you, there's times, I haven't smoked in, I don't know, since 1980, but there's times that, you know, I gotta have a cigarette, right? But a little part of my brain just goes, what makes you go, what makes you not care so much? What makes you just go, yeah, it's right over there, that's where it is, I'm going there. And get out of my way. What gives me the courage to do that? I drove a car. I won the chug-a-lug contest, which was great. I arrived from the gate. And I arrived. And I liked the way I felt. I was confident. I took Miss 38D and shoved her off the foot of that car. And I guess I was funny, and I had a hangover, and I couldn't wait to do it again. And at that age, you got to steal it. My dad had a business, and it was very easy to water his stuff down because there was dust on a lot of his bottles. Dust on the bottles in his cupboard. And he had a great little bar. I like bars. I don't know about you, but I love drinking in bars because there's hope in bars. There's always hope in bars. And there's something about, you know, there's always a solution in the bar momentarily. You know, it's just for a moment. But there's, you know, there's always a lawyer. Somebody's got something working out in the bar. There's always a doctor analyzing something. And one night, maybe there was the astronaut that was in there. Boy, he was buying everybody. Now, who is he? Who cares? He's buying, you know. And get the best songs you ever won on the jukebox, and it's just like, it was there for a little bit. Because alcohol got me there. And then there would go somewhere else, and then I have to go there and find it there. And I started running, and I started, I went off to college because my family just do that, and that's what we did. But by then I was getting in a little trouble, but I also won some contests. I went to the White House when I was 16 years old. I went to the United Nations. I was a young citizen of America chosen by the state of Iowa. They chose 2 from every state. So I won this contest because my older sister tried to win this contest, and she was... the hero child. She was the one she was my nemesis. She was the Mensa. She was the one who saved us from a fire and got an award from the governor. I was like, oh, God, come on, Nancy, really? What else can you do, you know? So I was Nancy's sister growing up the whole time, and I just don't want to forget, so I'm going to tell you now. She married well to a great lawyer guy. They met in college, and they were married for many, many years, and he died a few years ago of a really bad brain cancer, and they drank. They went to 81 countries, first class, 81 countries. And after Brandy was passing away, we had seen some things before maybe with her, but I never really saw her like that rubber-legged drunk. She was, you know, they had fine wine, or they took, after my dad died, they took my mother to all over Europe and places, and they just had a great time. And we went to find her, as I didn't make it as he was dying, I made it after. And she was living in squalor in Bucks County, Pennsylvania, in a beautiful, beautiful home with acres of land and a koi pond, and drinking. The liquor store said, well, at least 4 quarts of Jack Daniels you deliver every week. And she would walk to neighbors' homes without her shoes and in the cold and knock on doors and ask for food. My sister had become an alcoholic. My older sister. My nemesis, my protagonist, the one my whole life that I never measured up to. The one that I made amends over and over and over to, where she wouldn't still look me in the eye until 6 years ago. And then we were good. So we were good for a little while before she fell, had brain bleeds. She just fell and broke part of her femur and some other things, and she didn't know she was an alcoholic. She didn't want to be an alcoholic. She had Korsakoff syndrome. She had partially a wet brain that was never going to come back, and she had brain bleeds they had to fix. And she can't remember one of the 81 countries she went to. And she called me. Last week I talked to her, and she said, you know, my husband's dead. Did you know Charles died? And one time she asked me, you know, is our mother dead? She's sweet as pie, really sweet as pie, and present, but memory's gone. And that beautiful brain she had, too, is gone. And we didn't know. He protected her, and he knew he was an alcoholic, and until he was gone, she was pretty protected. So you never know. It's never too late. You know, it's never too late, but I was it. I was the one that broke my family's heart. I was the one that they didn't know what was wrong. My dad said, what's wrong with you? I said, you want to know, Dad? Sit down, I'll tell you. I was tired of, you know, people say that to you. What's wrong with you? I don't know why I get in this trouble. I don't know why I look the way I look. I don't know why I can't sit still. I don't know why I have to keep moving. I don't know why I'm doing so poorly in school. No, I don't know why I've got your credit card and racking up. I'm buying books, Dad, and then I would sell the books so I'd have money to take my fake ID and drink at Joe's place. But my dad sat me down. I sat him down. I said, Dad, you want to know? Because he would always say, "What? You look different. What's wrong with you? What's going on?" My dad loved me. I love my dad. I love my dad a lot. And I told him things that my dad couldn't fix. I told my dad things that had happened to me that my dad would probably have gone and fixed it. And I told my dad things that he didn't forget, I'm sure, because I didn't want him to help me, because I didn't know what was wrong with me. I had no idea what was wrong with me. I didn't know I was an alcoholic. We didn't have any in our family. No, none of them fell out of the tree. I just know that I love drinking and let's go. I love drinking and let's go. And I stayed one step ahead of myself for a long, long time. One step ahead. And eventually I caught up to me. There you go. Who's coming with me? Oh, it's you. You know? And it's always, you know, I still have that evil twin. I don't know about you, but she's still there. She wakes me up sometimes. She wakes me up in times of my joy and says, you know what? You know, it's like, why are you waking me up? I have that evil twin. I do take her for a ride sometimes. It's like a little thing I have to do. I put her in the car and I gave her a tuna fish sandwich once, and I strap her in, and I shut the door, and I say, we're going for a ride, and let's go, and I'll leave her at a bus stop. I'll put her little sandwich down at a bus stop and thank her for being in my life, and now I don't need you anymore, evil twin. Like, I can just take my alcoholism and set it on a bench somewhere. And then I, you know, thank her for being in my life, and I drive away and think, you know, see you, bye. And then she finds her way home. Now I do peanut butter because I don't want some person to find a mayonnaise tuna fish sandwich sitting in a bag on a bus stop. But she comes back. You know, my ism doesn't go away. I have alcoholism, not wasm. Boy, you know, I've learned so much in this program about how to stay here. Because there's been times he talked about, you know, 28 years, that how he was into self. And I've stayed here when I've been pissed off at you. I've stayed here when you betrayed me. That's a good one. Yeah, I'm a double Leo, man. You betray me, you know. The claws come out. And so that was a good one, to sit here and show you all how betrayed I was. But you didn't ask me to go. You just kind of looked at me, and somebody said to me, look at Sharon, she's got 10 years. Do you want what she's got? And I was like, oh, man, really? You gotta tell the newcomer that? I'm trying to help out here, you know? Sit down, shut up, listen, you know? It's like, you're mine, newcomer. You know, get in the car. That's what we did a lot of. Get in the car. We're driving to Sacramento. Just going to a meeting. Where are we going? Sacramento from L.A. And it was crazy. And she said, can we stop and go to the bathroom? No. Hold it. You know, I was insane at 10 years. But you didn't say you have to leave, Sharon. I just said, keep coming back. So life had a lot of things thrown at me in the last 46 years. And a lot of joys. The day my son was born. He's doing good. Non-alcoholic. Doesn't seem to have it. I've been waiting, but it didn't show up yet. And I just went and did a retreat with 120 women from all over, and it was fabulous. And my son sent me a little message. He said, that sounds beautiful, Mom. Have a good time. Be nice. Out of the mouths of babes. He's still coming at me. It's okay. It's all right. But, you know, my dad, I broke his heart. And my mother, I needed to come home once. This was, where was I? I had left college. I had moved to New York City. Oh, that was just so much fun. It was like the summer of love. And I worked in an ad agency. We had two-hour martini lunches every day. It was wonderful. And I was drinking age. And I tried to go back to college, and I couldn't paint anymore. And that was the first thing that I noticed that alcohol asked for, that King Alcohol asked for. And somewhere along the line, I had a slide across the bar by art talent, because King Alcohol said, paint or me. You win, buddy. You know, take my paint. Take my paint, take my easels, take my creativity. And then I couldn't do anything in art school, so I moved to Colorado to be a cowgirl, and I didn't ever get on a horse. Because I found the bars near Aspen, Colorado. And I got in some trouble there. I got some other people in trouble. And then, I don't know, I was at a party one night coming out of a blackout with an ocelot licking my arm. And that is, you know, is this a blackout or am I hallucinating? But no, you come out of blackouts, you got to figure out where you are and what's happening sometimes, very quickly sometimes. But the ocelot was really there licking my arm. And then there were a lot of people there. And I met a guy who looked like Bob Dylan, and I think he was Bob Dylan, I don't know, but we came to California together, and I ended up at the commune, and he went his way, I went mine. It was all very much fun, and I got kicked out of the commune because I drank the bong wine, because I'm a drinker. See, now I started to find people living on the edge, and even the people living on the edge didn't want to drink with me. So it was kind of strange that they took me to Mount Baldy outside of L.A. and said, we're going to go have a picnic, bring your things. I should have thought about it. I wasn't sharp that day. And I brought my things, and they went, bye, and left me and the dog they didn't like on the mountain together. So we hitchhiked back to Colorado, and it wasn't the same. And I went back home, and I had pancreatitis. My gallbladder was blown. And my mother said, you can stay here, but please stay out of your dad's way because you break his heart. I was like, come on, Mom. You and I are besties, Mom. I was the closest one to her. And I just thought, and the taverns closed at 2, those taverns, and I had to have my bottle with me all the time, and I was the thing that lived upstairs, and I had to have some help from the family doctor, and he was giving me, you know, these downers to calm me down, and I hated that because I just, I didn't like face down going, let's party. I wasn't that kind of girl. So, and then they sent me to therapists, and I don't talk. They don't want to see you if you don't talk for a couple of sessions. You know, I sat there and think, you figure it out, right? You're paying, my parents are paying you, figure it out. I'm not going to cop to anything. I'm having too much fun. But alcohol is starting to take my soul. And so I had to slide across the bar, the love of my dad. And I had a fight with a priest in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. I got him really mad. He was yelling at me outside the confessional. I got him really mad. So everybody was standing there looking at him and looking at me like, what'd she do, you know? And so I gave him my one finger peace sign and left, because that was all that was left from my peace sign, was one finger now. And boy, there's ways to make amends to all of those things when you come to AA. I don't know if you would have said, hey, kiddo, you're going to make amends for these things. Behave. What? Behave? I behave, and I'm doing what I want. It's a free country. And I started to be much more defiant and much more angry, and it propelled me. And everything that I had that was of love and kindness was becoming smaller and smaller and smaller, because it was just me and alcohol running. And I ended up in an organic farm, and somebody said, let me take care of you. Wrong. Farm, right? Agriculture, right? A lot of work. And we had a wood stove in northern Wisconsin. Non-insulated schoolhouse. Yeah, it was cold. You want to have tea, you got to make a fire. Everything froze. Everything stuck and froze when I woke up in the morning. I thought, never again. Never again. I don't know about you guys, but I don't like being cold. That was my last cold winter. And it was so cold, you couldn't bathe. I mean, you know what I mean? You just couldn't. And they didn't drink like me, and they didn't act like me, and they liked hootenanny music, and they played banjos, and they would sit me down after I was drinking my cheap wine, because they're boring. They're just drooling on themselves smoking that stuff. And they loved Pete Seeger, and we'd have some guy come over from Minneapolis and have this concert in somebody's big room, and I was like, I started, come on, play something fun, rock and roll, you know, dinner on your Rolling Stones. And I was like, shh, sit down. Here, you play the spoons. They made me sit there and play the spoons. And I just thought, I hate these people. And this guy and I had bought 85 acres of land together, and it was like, why? 50 head of organic sheep? Why? You know what they do. You got to clean the barn, make maple syrup, tap maple trees. Why? Why am I doing all this? And it hit me one day. I'm thirstier than these people. They don't drink like me. They don't want to party like me. And so they went to do private therapy. Somebody got a bunch of money, and they left me some money, and I got a lot of wine, and I screamed at the sheep and the hayloft. That was my primal, you know, I primal scream. They'd all run to one side, and then they come back, and they drink some more wine, scream again, like primally, and then they all run to the other side. But those sheep did me a favor. I had some Maui Waui seed and some very beautiful tilled soil in the backwoods that some sheep dung and some Maui Waui seed. Those seeds cracked open and grew, and they were beautiful in a short growing season. And that's what I did. They left town, and I went and harvested it, and I went into town to turn it into money. I'm getting out of Dodge. It's cold. It's starting to get cold again. I don't know where I'm going. I just don't want to be cold. Isn't that a good motive to go start a new life somewhere else? I don't want to be cold anymore. And they don't understand me. Who cares? Let's go somewhere else. So I went to do this deal and make some money, and I forgot it in hefty bags back in the kitchen and on the farm. So I joined the carnival because it was there. You know, and that's a day your mother wants to get a phone call. You did what? You're not in Wisconsin. You're not going to marry Phil? No, mother, I'm not. I'm. That's right. I thought I had stopwatch on, but I guess I'm timing myself to something. I'm not even sure what. But I like birds now. They used to really hurt my ears in the morning. It's like, shut up, those birds are too loud. I don't even know how to do it, honey. Let's see. All right, well, we'll stopwatch it. There we go. I know where it was, so we're good. Birds. Now I love them. They're part of the noise in my life. But there I was, yeah, there at the carnival and breaking my mother's heart. Now I can't even call home and talk to Mom. I can't go home. I can't. My dad and I didn't look at each other for 8 years, eye to eye. We didn't ride in the same car. We didn't sit at the same table. And so I was at this carnival, and I turned my humanity in. King alcohol or humanity? Humanity? Look at the world. Look at the world. What am I going to make a difference with? Let's just go. Let's just. So I drank my tequila, and my dog came with me, and my nice dog started to bite people on the midway. And You know, I wouldn't let kids win, and they would go tell their dad they did actually have a shooting gallery, and, you know, and they'd tell their dad that this woman wouldn't let us win, and she put the target back up and said to go away, and I did. And then the dads would come, and then they'd fight, and then the mace would come out, and then they would get everybody would have a big fight, and then they close the show. And those owners don't like that when you're part of that, you're closing the show. So Matt Armstrong, that happened twice. That was his show. And, you know, I learned how to be as excuse Arne. I learned how to be tough. I learned how to walk down the midway doing that. I learned how to leave me alone. I learned how to steal. I learned how to do all that. How do you make amends for that? Everybody expected you to steal if you were at the carnival. What are you talking about? You know, the guy that owns the shooting gallery, he knows what he's going to get every night if so many people are there. So I just take what's off the top. You don't take too much. And the gypsies trusted me until I lied to their daughters. And they put a green rabbit's foot on my joint one night. And I thought, they're cursing me. Well, they were trying to tell me something, because a couple stops later, Bogalusa, Louisiana, finest, came in the door at 8 o'clock in the morning at some cheap motel and rounded me up and rounded up everything I had and rounded, they knew where to find everything and rounded me up and cuffed me and didn't let me get dressed, and it was crazy. And I was with the new boyfriend, because that's where the potential is, girls, you know, the carnivals. And he had a pet skunk named Crank that was defunct. So the skunk went to jail. My dog went to jail. He went to jail. I went to jail. We all went to jail. And the carnival left town. Nobody came back. And I'll tell you, that's a call that your family wants to get. But I didn't tell them. My brother-in-law called them. And I was in there having DTs. I'd never had DTs before. Never. You know, I had the shakes. I knew what I needed to drink. I knew I had it. I didn't want to be without alcohol. You know, I put it in oranges in high school so we could have, you know, orange full of vodka at lunchtime. And so there, you know, I didn't want to be without alcohol. There I was having DTs. And it was a scary place to be. And after about a week, I don't know, maybe 10 days, they said, you know, come on, someone wants to see you. And they cuffed me and took me in a car and threw me in an office that there was, I realized it was a judge, a bail bondsman, and a lawyer. And then looked to my left and there was my dad. Got on a plane in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, rented a car from New Orleans, went to look for his daughter, and brought his checkbook. And we didn't look at each other. And I saw him, and I slid to the floor. And I sat on the floor, and I remember thinking, I'm just a grease spot on the bottom of a shoe. And that's kind of where it took me. And my dad and I didn't look at each other. I was 20 years sober before I could talk to him about that day. 20 years. You know how smart we are when we go make amends with family. I said, Dad, do you remember the day when? Yes, I do. And he said, all you said that whole time was, I'm not guilty and it's not my fault, because I had become the perfect victim. Don't sit by me playing Ray Price for the good times. Let me drink some gin, because I'm going to tell you why I'm a perfect victim. I'm going to tell you whose fault it is. I had a list. And if I start building a case in here, I'm in trouble. I need you. I need you, this table over there of all of you. I need you, the table over here of all of you. I need you. I need to remember how close we are. Norm Alfie is a speaker that spoke a lot around, all around, and he talked about seconds and inches, and we are the lucky ones by seconds and inches to get to come and hear Chapter 5 read, to get to come and sit with somebody who, oh, yeah, I did that too. It's by seconds and inches that we are breathing in and out with the solution for alcoholism. Right here. It blows my mind that I was lucky enough to come to you. After that situation, I lived in the French Quarter, and it was crazy and dark and fun and wild. And I, you know, I was a local. I loved the bars. I loved everything about it. I had blackouts. I'd wake up in other states. I mean, My big thing now I was working on was to take better care of myself in my blackouts. That was my big quest. You know, I danced for Chris Owens. She just died. I got this whole big article about her 500 Club on Bourbon Street. She was crazy, and I danced off the piano too many times, and so they fired me because I asked for a raise. I thought I did really a good job, and so I became a bartender, and I was walking down the street once from one bar to the next bar, and worked in local places, and I would actually get really drunk and get tired of having the patrons, and I'd want to listen to my song on the jukebox over and over again. So I would kick them all out. No, this is like, you know, Friday night in Bourbon Street, right? And I'd lock the door, and I'd sit there with my booze, my tequila, and I would listen to my song over and over again. Then somebody would call Mike, the owner, and go, "Hey, Mike, your store's closed." He'd go, "What? My store's closed." So then he would get down and come on. I'd see him at the door going, "Please open up, Cher. Please open up." And I changed my name to Cher, S-H-A-R-E. "Please open up, Cher. Please open up." I go, "Mike, I can't. My life, you know. Oh, my God. Drinking gin. And he just put me in the back and worked my shift. But eventually, I had such a bad attitude, I got fired. Nobody in the quarter would hire me anymore. That's pretty bad. The local joints, the ones you can smell the bathrooms, you know, when you walk in going, "Oh, that smell of stale booze and bathrooms." Yeah, and that was my last place. And nobody wanted to come and have a free drink with me anymore. My alcoholic friends didn't. I was like Bill in the story. I'd become the lone wolf. I was the lone wolf. That's where I was. And I didn't care because it's all going to be over soon anyway, and then you'll be sorry. My defiance kept me going. And 1975, I went through with my friend Michael, was shot and killed Mardi Gras Day outside my door. I didn't know what happened. We were friends with somebody in the force, and he said, "Sharon, leave town. They found something in your apartment," because what I happened in Louisiana was on the record, believe me. And I was going to do some time, so I left town. And I ran to New York, and I came back to California, and I came back to New Orleans, and nobody won. I had that alcoholic stuttering when I got off the plane. I thought, what's happening to me? And nobody here wants to party with me anymore. My friend said, "Sharon, we went out with you, and you stood by the, you put catatonic by the wall for 4 hours." I did? Wow. I didn't know myself anymore. I'm now sleeping on a couch. I ended up trying to go to Hawaii, and I landed in California, and it took me 20 years to go to Hawaii. I finally made it sober. Whew, thank God. But I was unemployed. I had a backpack. Dogs are gone. Cats are gone. Men are gone. All of that's gone. I have a backpack with the book Be Here Now by Baba Ram Dass, and I had my booze, and I had my couple of pair of clothing, and my Panama hat. So you wouldn't look in my eyes. I was bloated, toxic, sick a lot, and I didn't know what I was going to do. And people took me in, let me sleep on their floors. And I remember this one place that was a garage that had cots, and if you got there in time, you got to go sleep on a cot. And there was always booze in the freezer. And I would lay there and wait for my turn. That's what it took for my defiance to just, I'm out in the back of a motorcycle outside of Barney's Beanery in West Hollywood, and I first saw the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous was in that bar. She was really drunk, and the bartender said, "You're not going to drive, Chris, with that. You're not going to drive to your A&A meeting drunk. Here, give me the keys. I'll call you a cab." And we're all looking around, and I guess she had her court card signed or something. People were signing her court card at the bar so they could give it to her. And she had this book, and she was really, really drunk. And I remember seeing her kind of go out, she was holding on the wall and had that book and fell out the door into a taxi, and we took her drinks. She's like, "Good for you, Chris, go to A&A. She was going to be my Eskimo to you. She was going to be my Eskimo to you. So I went out to Palm Springs. I had a good time, and it was July 27th, and I ran into some people, I guess, that didn't like me so much, and I was passed out in the back of the car, and my new friend left me in the back of the car, and they drove away with me and had their way with me and rolled me off the side of the road on July 27th, 1975, with my jaw broken, 3 places, and my nose. I was pretty scraped up, bruised, and very, very, had a concussion. And as I was laying there that morning, I heard the car door slam, and I thought, my defiance said, "Get up. they're coming back. And I lifted my head and I heard a voice that I couldn't get up. Get up, I want to live. That was my moment. And I guess I heard it, and I don't really remember much what happened, but I ended up in the hospital, and when the police were there, and it was just a whole big thing. And I was in the hospital for 2 weeks, and I had a detective, and I couldn't even, my jaws wired all shut. I couldn't touch my cheekbones for 6 months. They were so bruised. And I laid there in that, and I just give me some more morphine, give me some more morphine, give me some more morphine. And they felt sorry for me. And on my birthday, they brought a little glass of wine in and a straw because I can't eat. It's all wired shut. And they had a little banner for me. They felt bad for me, the nurses. And they left the room, and I took a sip. I said, oh, my God, alcohol. And I put it through the wires through where the tooth had been kicked out. And I'm sucking on that alcohol, and it repulsed me. It's like, what? I literally threw it down the drain. Never in my, I drank it with, I was having a chug-a-lug contest, came out of a blackout with some of my vomit in it when I realized that I'm not going to lose, right? I shoved it back down. I don't waste alcohol, period. And there I am pouring it down the drain. And I threatened my roommate to not tell anyone. I couldn't talk for her. Don't tell her. She's in a coma. But I'm like thinking it's so ironic. I'm throwing alcohol down the drain. It was something I'd never done. And that's the way I came to you. For 3 months, I couldn't talk. It was such a bad break. You were very lucky. I had to learn to listen. I couldn't talk. And it was really a miracle that I came in desperate and broken. So on August 20th, the guy had said I could stay with him. He lived above the liquor store. He was buying me that cheap wine. And I was drinking it now. And he'd buy the cheap wine. I'd sit at a table all day long. He'd go to work. He'd come back with some cheap wine. I'd pass out, do it again tomorrow. And one day he said to me, you know what? You got to leave. You're depressing me. I was like, kick in the gut. And I called my mom. I had nowhere to go. Nowhere to go. It was August 20th, 1975. And my mom said, Sharon, I can't help you anymore. Go to the Salvation Army. Seconds and inches. My mom would always send me something. I would have waited for a $20 bill. And she said no. And I looked down. There was a phone number. And the guy that said I could come stay with him let me sleep on his couch because he knew I had nowhere to go. I was dating that girl, Chris, the girl in the bar with the big book that fell into the taxi cab. And her number was there. And she was always nice to me. I thought, I can call that girl. So she knew what had happened to me because she sent him out to get me. I didn't know that. So, I can't phone her. So she said, I can't help you, but call Suzanne. And she was drinking that day, so she couldn't help me. And so I called a stranger. I don't call a stranger. I don't ask for help. I just handle it, whatever it is. And I called the stranger. And she knew where the liquor store was because it was the alcoholic liquor store, I guess. They sold out the back. They took bad checks. They delivered after hours. Everybody knew the Duck Pond Liquor Store. Duck Pond Liquor Store. And I couldn't talk. So she got it. And she does where she said, go sit on the stairs. She knew where to tell me to sit. And she said, put your drink down, put your joint down, and someone's going to come get you. And I went, how does she know I'm working both? I was like, she got my attention. And I went and sat on the steps, just like she told me to. And this car pulled up. I don't know where I'm going. I need a place to stay. I don't know I'm going to go have this brand new life. I did spiritually well and help people and share your experience, strength, and hope and look at yourself and try to change and be a better person and make amends. And no. I'm going to stand in front of the next bus, please. That's where I was going. And this car pulls up, and you get me in the car. I can't even look at you. You're so bright. You're so bright with your smiles, and the car's bright, and you're all bright. And I'm in the back of a Volkswagen, and I can't get out. I can't get out. And I'm detoxing here. They did try to take me to a woman's recovery house, and I walked in, and the woman went, no. No. And you know what? I wasn't even offended. I wasn't even offended. I just slept on floors. You were taking care of me from the beginning. I had no idea. But I get to this church, and I thought, oh, here we go. Me and God, but I need a bed, so I'll play the game. I don't know where I am. I just know there's a lot of people there, and there's a guy talking like this, and he got me. He hooked me. I think there's a hook from my solar plexus to somebody else's solar plexus that will wake up a little spark, that divine spark, whatever it is, just a little bit of kindling on the fire of life, because we have it for here. I was like, I had a spark. You were throwing that kindling out. What that man said to me was, he always waited for the spaceship to land and say, "You can come home now, Bill." And I thought, I waited for that spaceship in Iowa. I was six looking for it. Oh, man, spaceship people. I really thought I found my spaceship people, and I was happy about it for a minute. And then this man put this book in me, Alcoholics Anonymous. Is that where I am? Alcoholics Anonymous? And it got my name out of me. I wrote it in pencil and wrote the date and where I was. I still had that second edition big book and written in pencil. And I had no idea that I was going to have a brand new life, nor did I want one. But I was willing enough to go, okay, I put down some weapons. I put down my defiance. I was not even ready to track anything much. But what you did was you said, okay, the sponsor said, wait for the liquor store lights to turn off before you send her upstairs. So they sat in the car in August with no windows that rolled down the back, with an unwashed, broken, can't speak, detoxing, coming from my pores, sweating alcoholic, and shared parts of their story with me. And all I could think of was, you're talking a lot about yourself. It's like I didn't know what this was. She's talking. Okay, now she's talking. Okay. And I was really, but there was something that there was, it was your kindnesses. It was your kindnesses that kept me here. Because some man said to me, "You look tired, kid." I thought, how's he know? And he said, "Take your backpack off and stay with us a while." And I don't know, maybe he invited me for 30 days or something, and then he walked away and he came back. And he said, "No, you look really tired, kid. Why don't you stay with us?" I think he said 60 or 90 days, or whatever it was. He invited me for longer, and I thought that was nice. And I remembered that man. And so they moved me out of the liquor store. I slept on floors. And eventually somebody gave me a sleeping bag, and eventually I got a sponsor because they wouldn't be quiet about finding somebody. And, you know, my friend Sandy Beach used to talk about the big book. And the big book is, it's not the treasure, it's the treasure map. It's the treasure map. And you got to have a guide. The guide's got to take you through that treasure map, show you where to go. I mean, we're going to go hiking tomorrow. I'm not going to go without water or some, you know, power bars and some chocolate. Thank you very much, you guys. You know, and we're going to go for a hike, and we're going to have a map. We're going to know where we go. And, you know, but I can't go through this. I need a guide. I don't know what this is about. I need someone that's got the light in their eyes, that knows what they're talking about, who's been down the road, who takes the time to come and sit with me and share their experience and help me find. Clancy was my sponsor for 37 years. I had Ginny 5 years. I had Janet 5 years. And then Clancy at 10 years when my life fell apart because my sponsor smoked pot. And, you know, he was the kind of guy that showed me what to do. He showed me where. He walked over people at the Midnight Mission every day that were dying of alcoholism and kept the doors open and kept the lights on for those people. And he did things that people didn't see. I mean, big bravado. He did things that people didn't see. When I went through my messy divorce because he left me for the newcomer in the room, that was fun. Nobody got custody of the meeting. And... And he, you know, he was louder than my head, thank God. And I got on his postcard list. He used to go all these places, and he would write 50 postcards. And it would be people who needed to get a postcard or people who were in his mind. Always got a postcard. I had a stack of postcards from him. That was the kind of little stuff he did. And when I went through that divorce at 10 years, I didn't have any money. And people were coming to my house for Thanksgiving because they always came to our house. Now he's over there with her making Thanksgiving dinner. But, you know, so I was just going to make some potatoes and hope somebody brought something. And Clancy got word of it, and he said that the guys take her some food, because they always served turkey dinners at the Midnight Mission. Always did. And somebody knocked on the back door, and they had all those plastic, those, you know, metal bins, whatever they are, of turkey and stuffing, and potatoes and gravy and green bean casseroles and all of it and yams. And because he knew. Somebody told him. I was 10 years sober. I had to let down my guard. My dad walked me down the aisle at 2.5 years, Boy Meets Girl in AA campus. I slept on my sponsor's couch for I don't know how long with that borrowed sleeping bag, reading 3 pages of the book at night. When she first started with me, I couldn't even talk. I had to do a lot of writing. Because, the first, and when we did the third step together, I was like, she's so excited we're doing this third step. I'd be like, okay. It's like I'm staying at your house. I'll do what you want. So she was so excited about this third step we did. The curtains are open, the door is open, the kids are home, and she's reading it, and I'm trying to read all the book. And she gets up and hugs me really hard. Because now she knows we're going to get moving. And I'm like, I'm going to hit her. It's like, stop hugging me, Janet. And I had my first pause. I thought, I'm going to hit her, but then everybody will know. Sharon hit her sponsor. And there was something about wanting your approval more than I wanted to be defiant at that moment. So I just stayed there and let her do it, and then I melted in her arms. And then because my brain has been saturated for years, my first thought was, I must be gay. I think I'm in love with my sponsor. That's my thinking. It's not very sharp. And so I told her that. She went, what? So I had to say it again. And she said, well, let's don't make any major decisions in your first day. Boy Meets Girl at AA campus. And I had gone home and made amends to my family at 1 year of sobriety after I finally did that inventory. Oh, my God. I couldn't remember things. I felt like I was scrambled, and I would have this anxiety attacks and hyperventilate. And I had a partner to call at the beginning. Okay, so she had problems too. We're starting to write, right? Okay, we write for an hour, and they call each other. She'd call me in an hour. I go, how's it going? Oh, good. How's it going? Okay. And then the dam broke, because I'll tell you why. There was a woman behind me for 8 days. 8 days less than me. I had 8 days more than her. And I hope you got somebody on your tail, because her name was Pat Wise. She's still sober today. And she came in and she cried. And all the old timers, so I had 8 days of attention, went to her. They just went, I get the second string of old timers. What's happening here, And people learning to work with a newcomer, I got the string of. And all the old timers went right to Pat. She cried all the time. And, Pat's done her third step. Do you know she's working on her fourth step? Like, I care, but I didn't say that. And Pat was just, like, whipping through the steps and always crying. And then somebody said to me, Pat's doing amends already. What? She's doing amends already? And she'd look at me across the room, and I'd look at her. She had that thin little blue lip, I'm better than you look. I don't care about those 8 days. It's not about quantity, it's about quality. And it's like, I know, that's what her look said. She never said that, but that's what her look said. So I would sit there and I would just like, ugh. So I was ready to drink without finishing my inventory. I got to tell you, it was painful. And I was on my way out the door at the Palm Springs Roundup. I was having a lot of feelings, because that's where that all had happened that I was pretty numb about. And I was going out the door because I went to try to hug somebody. Oh, I see somebody I know. She said, my sunburn. And I thought, screw this, I'm going to drink. I mean, that was all it took. I was in that much pain. And I was on my way out the door. There was a guy standing there. Always was somebody standing at the door. You were talking about it, Bill. Always somebody standing there. He saw me going and he saw my intensity. And he just said, hey, what's happening, Sharon? And then I started to cry. And then I told him, And I was having all these feelings. He just listened for a while. He said, Dale, there's the liquor store. You can go down there and buy your vodka. And he kind of looked at me and said, and then you'll have less time than Pat. So Pat saved my life. I came to the Pacific Group on my first day, and I'm still there today. And I have so much history with these people. I have so much love for this family of mine, this community of mine. And we've scattered. We've all gone ways. People have died. People have come. Babies are born. Divorces happen. Second husband, third husband, whatever, But we're all here. We're all here. Life doesn't have to take you out. This will take me out. Centers in my mind, that evil twin. My heart is what grows here. Broken, open hearts heal bigger. My heart is what grows here. The kindnesses you showed me. Just the kindnesses. Just to be, you know, people would put money in my purse when I was new. People, you know, and I get to do that if you're not looking sometimes. Now, there's lots of ways. And then I went home and I made those amends to my dad after I finally did my inventory. We finally looked at my few defects I had. I couldn't even get, they were his, my new bow. But we kind of finally got to me eventually. The defiance is my taproot. It talks about the taproot and the 12 and 12, and I got one. And everything grows from that thing. And you think you're weeding it out, and you guys know about agriculture, that taproot, you've got to have a lot of water and a lot of strength to pull it up, and it seems to sprout new roots every now and then. But that keeps me in line, knowing that, because I like to be in the comfort of the spirit. I like to be sleeping good at night. I like waking up going, oh, God, I'm sober. My dog thinks her name's God sometimes. God, 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 God. Dog's still backwards, too, so there's a little something there. You know, I don't know if you have a dog. You don't go rescue one. I mean, that's my amends. Is if you're whining about yourself, go rescue a cat if you're lonely. You know, go do something good. Go to the mailbox and come back, and that dog, you just saw me 5 minutes ago, and I come back, she goes, ah, you're home. You know, and that's just the joy. Oh, that's how my God is with me. I can go away and he goes, come on, come sit down. I've been waiting for you. You know, God doesn't move, I do. And so I made those amends to my dad, and they were short and sweet, and boom, nobody looked, and there was no hugging. And I got in the car, and I got on the plane, and I went back to LA, and my sponsor said, you do it? And I said, yeah. She said, what do you say? That he always wanted me to be happy. Okay, go home happy. Call home happy. Remember his birthday. Send Christmas presents on time. I can do that. Well, he came out and walked me down the aisle, and you guys took him to a meeting. And then he bought the big book. My dad's a businessman. So he was reading the book one day, and he goes, most alcoholics owe money. Let me read this part here. And my brother said, he got my dossier out, because he's a businessman. Everything is written down. There's every receipt. There's everything in that dossier. He said it was quite thick. And I didn't know that. I didn't know he ran a calculator tape and put it in the big book by his chair. My mother said, what's this? And he said, look, if Sharon gets sober and stays sober long enough and gets to this part of the book, and if she calls home and I'm not here, here it is circled in red. And I have this sponsor, Jenny, now, and she said, it's time to call your dad and pay him back the money you owe him. And I went, how does she know about the money? You know, because they've been there. They've been there. So I called my dad one day, and he said, it's this much. And I went, I didn't even think that he was quick about it. It was so high. That was my, like, what? And I forgot about the car I took. Yeah, so that was in there. And I called my sponsor, and she said, call him up and make payment terms. And I'm like, why am I doing this? He just wants me to be happy. So he said, you know, okay, that's good. And I called her back. She said, good, then don't miss a payment. Do not miss a payment. Your dad needs to see consistency. Your dad needs to see that you mean what you say. Your dad needs to have that check on time every month. And by the way, you're willing to grow through it with your dad? Willing to grow through it with my dad? We're not growing together. What's she talking about? I know, but a sponsor gets you in the corner and asks for one more thing that they know can happen for you that you don't think can happen for you at all. And she said, are you willing to grow through this with your dad? And I said, okay. She said, first of all, be on time with that check, because Bill and Bob are watching. It's like, what? I don't care if the Pope's watching or the Dalai Lama. Bill and Bob, I'm going to send it on time. And people say all that time, you're an example of AA or an example of Bill and Bob. And I just seem to straighten up because I have such respect for what happened, how this got together. I don't know, you know. To me, it's just mind-blowing. That this each little stone was put in place that we get to sit here today and judge the speaker, judge the coffee, whatever it is. You know, whatever it is. But you get a chance to sit here and maybe something opens up. Maybe the identification happens. Maybe somebody takes an interest in you. Maybe the kindness. Maybe the winks from God start happening. And you go, we just had a wink from God over here. Things in the flow with God, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, the people I love, not having to look over my shoulders to see the forgiveness was for my dad. My dad got a check and a note on time for 4 years and 10 months, and then the day after Christmas, he said, Merry Christmas, daughter, I don't want your money anymore. Merry Christmas, daughter, but don't stop sending the notes. And it was a healing I didn't think would happen. So much so that I had this moment with my dad. And Bill loves this story. Pete loves this story. We were together all day in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, doing errands. Just me and my dad, looking eye to eye, hanging out. Took me to the coffee klatch. No women allowed, but he wanted to introduce me to his coffee klatch. And we were going home, and it was a hot August day. I don't know. My son was, and I'd been through the messy divorce. They were there for all of it. You know, Sister Sheila was there for all of it. 49. She's 60 years in the convent, and I've sponsored her for just about 40 years. And I made amends to the Catholic Church through sponsoring Sister Sheila because I found peace and love there. I find peace and love here. I find peace and love out in the world. I can take my God with me wherever I go. So we're sitting there, and my dad said, do you want to have a root beer? And I said, yeah. So we get out of the car, and we go have a root beer at the root beer stand, and I'm about ready to go back in the car and drink it. And he said, no, we're going to go sit over there. There's a shade tree. It's a nice evening. Let's go sit in the shade tree on the picnic table. So we sat at this picnic table across from each other, looking at each other, having our root beers, just dad and the daughter. And if you'd been getting your root beer, you would have looked over and gone, look at dad and the daughter having a chat. Look at dad and the daughter having a chat. It was that easy. And if you would have looked under the picnic table, you would have seen my legs swinging like a little 6-year-old girl because I had no idea the innocence could come back. I had no idea that forgiveness is forgiving. Forgiveness is forgiving. You give it. Sister Sheila, my son got kicked out of after that messy divorce. That's the whole thing. Clancy wouldn't let me throw the hot coffee. You'll walk through it with dignity and grace. But I don't want to. They're over there and they're happy and they're getting married, pregnant and married in that order. Come on, really? And you guys all knew about it and nobody told me. So I'm punking out with my hair and my attitude and my ripped jeans and my My Doll shirt going to Cramps concerts. And I'm mad. You know, and that's when that lady looked at me and said, look at Sharon, she's got 10 years in what she's got. And I just hissed at her. But I wanted to help the newcomer. I wanted to help the newcomer. And Clancy would let me throw that coffee. And as he left her for number three, we're best friends. We raised our kids together. She said, you're my example of dignity and grace walking through that. What? You were the only one I didn't want to have it. I didn't want to be example to you. But we laugh about it now. And we raised those kids together, those boys. And who knew in Alcoholics Anonymous? Sister Sheila, my son got kicked out of kindergarten. That was not a good beginning for this little boy, but he was leaving school and taking people with him, so it was a little hard at 5, running away from school in a busy street. So they said, no, we don't want him here, and so I called Clancy, and I'm dying. It's like, my life is over. My son's kicked out of school, really? And so he said, take him to Sister Sheila, who was principal of the school. I said, my sponsor her. And he said, she's a principal of a school. Take him there. She said, okay, come on. We'll make room. Well, he loved the uniforms. He loved the structure. He loved how they let him be creative. I mean, he worked on it. He had to work on things, but he's a very creative. He found his passion in life, and they helped him. And I was, you know, being in there trying to help Sister Sheila with whatever I could because, you know, that Catholic Church is right over there. And they have a school carnival every year, and they needed somebody to help. And so I raised my hand, and I felt somebody tug it up. It was probably God. Here you go, carnival. All those little boys you ripped off. Here you go. So for 8 years, from kindergarten through eighth grade, I bought those kids ride tickets. I worked at that carnival, whatever they needed. And as I remember, my son was graduating that year from eighth grade, and all those boys that were like this at one time going, Wesley's mom buys tickets, Wesley's mom, you know. It's like then they grew and they grew and they grew, and they were like this tall, and passing out the tickets and talking to all of them. And I knew that I was free, just by being of service and saying yes to the next wink from God. So my life is good today. I just want to quickly tell you that I met Casey, my my love of my life, and we were together 24 years, and he loved golf, and he loved AA, and we were married 5 of those 24 years, and we didn't live together. We lived 10 minutes apart, and I was raising my son and building a career, and he died of malignant melanoma in my arms, and it'll be 11 years on June 3rd, and he was a good member of AA, and there was peace and love in that home. And a lot of God. We had, you know, the Buddhist chanting and the Sister Sheila over here, and we had a guitar picker playing blues. Got it covered in a house full of AA love. And I had been to a house full of AA love with a woman that I sponsor and her man, Mickey, just a few months ago. And then we just lost our friend Jeff a week ago, who I know for 40 years. He's a great guy, and I sponsor his wife, and they have a love story. Seize the moment. Be awake. Wake up to all of the joy in life, all of the sadness. All I can do is maybe put a smile out there one day. That's it. Because I want to know when I walk into a room that I'm happy to see you. That I'm happy to see you. I'm happy to be here. And 10 years I've been a widow, and then I meet this man, Pete. And I fell in love again. What? I fell in love again. We fell in love with each other. Dating on FaceTime for 7 months. Meeting on Zoom meetings of AA. It wouldn't have happened that way, you know. They always say, don't sleep with them for 30 days, the sponsors, right? You know, and if you make 27, you're happy, you know. And like, but we knew each other for 7 months before we met, and it was effortless. And so my life has changed again, you know. And I'm semi-retired, and my son is out there doing his career. And you know, my home is happy. And, you know, my dad got killed in 99, and it was a rough time. On his land on a freak accident, walked out of my mother's life and never came back for dinner. And my mother came to Alcoholics Anonymous and loved you, and you loved on her. And then we lost Clancy a year and almost 2 years ago in August, it'll be. And what we carry on. We leave a legacy. There's something about what we get to leave here. A spark in somebody else. Maybe you threw a little kindling on somewhere. Now, maybe something happened, like Diana. I met Diana tonight. We had a moment about something in 1995, and we got to share it. And John and I were just talking about the same moment, and that was a wink from God. Something from 1995 where we were all there. And there's all there everywhere. And my job is just to love. Everlasting love I'll never get to. Everlasting love I'll never get to. But I have a lot of love to give. And it's not just here. I take it out there. And I got to hold my mother when she was 95, and you treated her so well when she came here. You loved on her, and you gave her so many good nights of sleep. Thank you. Thank you, Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you that every mother that gets to sleep, they say if you're new, and I know there's a lot of you new here, that 10 people's lives are better the moment you walk in here and sit down with us because they know there's hope. That's that one thing I couldn't find wherever I went. Was hope. And that's what got me in here. And a day at a time, I've been able to sit with you when it's good, sit with you when it's hard, sit with you when I'm happy, sit with you when I'm sad, and to constantly, constantly, constantly go to my God, morning and night, go and have somebody that's my sponsor. I need a sponsor. I need somebody that I can talk to, and the woman I have now saw me come in the program, and I'm so grateful. She's moved away, and she came back to L.A., and she saw me come in. We played softball together. You think you're going to be bored here? Come on. I've done bungee jumping on. I water ski every year, you know. Something to be said about being healthy and sober. Something to be said about it. And that's what I just try to give away everything I have. There's a guy I like. He's a mystic called Blake, and he went to India because he wasn't having any inspiration. And this is in the 1800s. And he was sitting by the Ganges River waiting for inspiration. And he saw these boats on fire going down. It's a big, big, big river. And he saw these boats on fire going down at sunset. And what are these boats on fire? What is this? And he waited a while, and he wasn't getting any other inspiration. And this man walked by, and he said, are you a local? And he said, yes. He said, can you tell me what's going on? And he said, yeah, we're honoring our dead. And what we do is we have a boat that we put the body in, we put them in linen, we give them everything they love in life. Everything they love in life, we put in that boat with them. And we set it on fire. And we push it down the river in a ceremony. And I thought, wow, what would I want? I'd want the big book. I'd want the feather of a raven. I'd want some hair of my son. Hair of my dog. I cut hair when they go. I'd want pictures of my family. I'd want a shirt of the man I love so I could smell it one more time. I'd want all of the love that I have gotten in Alcoholics Anonymous wrapped around me tight in every single memory. And I want some music. Play the accordion. It's okay. And Billy said, you know, he sat there for a while and he thought about all these boats and all these lives just going by, going by, going by. And he had his moment. And I love his moment. He said, when I go, because we all do, and you put in the boat everything I love, and you light me on fire, and you push me down. May I be all used up. Thanks for having me.